Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, October 20th, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our telephone will discuss asbestos litigation. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very happy to have with us today two panelists. We're going to hear first from Professor Lester Brickman. He is a professor at the Yeshiva University, Benjamin N. Cardoza School of Law in New York. His opening remarks will be followed by some comments by Mark A. Behrens. Mr. Behrens is a partner at the Shakarty and Bacon law firm right here in Washington, D.C. Then we might have a little back and forth between the two of them. But as always, we're going to be turning to our audience for your questions. So please do be ready with your questions when we get to that portion of the program. And with that, Professor Brickman, please go ahead and get us started.
Well, as everyone knows, asbestos litigation has gone on for several decades and continues to flourish, if that's an appropriate word, in this, with regard to this tragedy. Because of the long latency period for the asbestos-related diseases, there have been special provisions added to the bankruptcy code to deal with asbestos-caused bankruptcies. The number of companies that have been bankrupted exceeds 100, and they include such substantial companies as Owens Corning, Fiberboard, U.S. Gypsum, Armstrong World Industries, Federal Mogul, Pittsburgh Corning, W.R. Grace, and many others. When these companies go bankrupt, they set up trusts under special bankruptcy provisions funded with their assets that are determined by the bankruptcy judge in something called an estimation proceeding to determine the amount of assets that have to be placed into the trusts to pay for pending and future claims. And the rules require that the amount for future claims be set aside, in essence, so as to protect those who are not yet come down with the disease, but will in some cases do so. So the trusts at this point have assets of about $30 billion, which is an enormous sum, of course, and despite the fact that they've already paid out $20 billion to claimants. When the trust became substantial with regard to the assets, a number of defendants anticipated that their share of the liability in the tort system would diminish because the shares of the reorganized companies were now back in the picture, so to speak, in the form of the trusts. In fact, this has not happened. The opposite has occurred, and I set out to answer the question of why this happens. And in simple terms, my answer is that plaintiffs' counsels have been able to erect a wall between trust claims and tort cases in order to maximize revenues for the tort cases by denying defendants any offsets and the ability to argue in the trials for a lower share of liability because of the larger exposures these plaintiffs had to the products of the reorganized companies. Now, all of this played out in a recent estimation proceeding before U.S. bankruptcy judge George Hodges, presiding over the bankruptcy of the Garlock Sealing Technologies Company, which is a manufacturer of garlocks, of gaskets. And in the estimation proceeding, the plaintiff's experts argue for the most substantial possible transfer of assets, and the debtor's expert is at the opposite end of the spectrum and arguing for a much lower amount. Now, in the case of Garlock, the plaintiff's expert testified that the amount necessary to pay pending and future Garlock claims would be approximately $1.3 billion. And the debtor's expert testified that the amount required was much lower, in fact, $125 million, basically a tenth of what the plaintiff's expert testified to. Now, in most asbestos bankruptcies estimation proceedings, historically, bankruptcy judges have essentially adopted the plaintiff's expert's argument as to the determination of the amount to be set aside, and that usually has resulted in the deprivation of all equity, the consuming of all equity in the company. Here, in the case of Garlock, what is in fact a unique event in the annals of asbestos bankruptcies occurred when the bankruptcy judge allowed Garlock to keep most of its equity by coming up with a figure of $125 million. Now, the judge, Judge Hodges, in a stunning and unprecedented order, not only determined that it would be $125 million, but also that he gave his reasons for doing so, and the reasons were that that Garlock had demonstrated that plaintiff's counsel had withheld exposure evidence in a widespread and organized way from the defendant in the tort system, from Garlock. And Garlock was forced to settle a number of these cases for large sums. These plaintiffs, when deposed by Garlock, testified that they had not had any other exposures except to Garlock and maybe a few other companies, to the products of those companies. And then either prior to that or during that time or subsequent to that time, they filed claims with 15, 20, 25 trusts in which they swore under penalty of perjury, as filled out by their counsel, that they had meaningful and credible exposure to the products of those reorganized companies. That is to say, to the products that they denied their exposures to in the course of the proceeding against Garlock in the tort system. And Judge Hodges found that that process infected Garlock's settlements in the 2005 to 2010 period when Garlock went bankrupt, in such a way that the plaintiff's expert's projection based upon those settlements in that five-year period could not be relied on because of the what he said was the infected nature of those settlements, infected by the hiding of this evidence, by the suppression of the evidence of these other exposures. So Garlock becomes a very important case in the annals of asbestos litigation, and it is presently continuing in litigation. Undoubtedly, there will be numerous appeals, but the court's finding in Garlock is really untouchable. The finding with regard to the evidence about suppression of other exposures. And so today we're going to discuss what some of those consequences are. I have laid all this out in a recent law review article titled Fraud and Abuse in Mesothelioma Litigation, which appears at 88 Tulane Law Review 1071, which was published a couple of months ago. And so now I invite Mark to comment and to add to anything he wishes to do.
Well, thank you, Professor. That's an excellent summation of the background behind the decision and the court's findings. And I thought I would give a few examples when the Judge Hodges said that he found evidence of widespread suppression of evidence. What he had looked at, as the professor had indicated, was a sampling of 15 cases where, in the bankruptcy proceeding, Garlock was able to go back in cases where it had been represented during discovery and up through and including trial that the plaintiffs had either no other exposures other than to the Garlock gasket, or the plaintiffs could not recall any other exposures other than to their product. And Judge Hodges found that in each and every one of those instances involving five different plaintiffs' firms over a very broad period of time, that in every single case, the plaintiffs, where they had said they either knew of no other exposures or had no other exposures, they subsequently filed claims with bankruptcy trust where they signed affidavits saying that they were exposed to these other products and used that to obtain payments in every case. For example, there was a California case that Judge Hodges talked about that Garlock settled for $450,000, where a former sailor denied that he ever saw anyone installing or removing pipe insulation on his ship. After he settled with Garlock, the plaintiff's lawyers filed 11 trust claims on his behalf, seven of which were based on declarations that the plaintiff personally removed and replaced insulation and identified by name the products to which he was exposed. It was more of the same in another case in New York that settled during trial for $250,000. The plaintiffs denied any exposure to insulation products, according to the judge. After the case settled, however, the plaintiff's lawyers filed 23 trust claims on the plaintiff's behalf, including eight trust claims that were filed within 24 hours of the settlement with Garlock. And the judge said because that this was a widespread practice that came up in every single claim that they had sampled, that he could not look at the past settlements of Garlock as a reliable indicator of their true liability because they were infected by this suppression of evidence. Now, the judge does not use the word fraud in his opinion, but throughout it he says that there is suppression of evidence. And in particular, he says that while it is not suppression of evidence for a plaintiff to be unable to identify exposures, it is suppression of evidence, he said, for a plaintiff to be unable to identify exposures in the tort case, but then later, and in some cases previously, to be able to identify it in the trust claims. The decision, when it came out, has generated substantial attention within the bar, the asbestos bar, plaintiff and defense, and within mainstream media. There were editorials written about the decision in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. NPR broadcast a story calling Garlock a watershed moment, and the Huffington Post said that plaintiffs who have played by the rules by honestly seeking compensation from the companies that actually caused them harm are losing out to plaintiffs willing to, what they say, to become perjury pawns for those who would game the system. It is a very significant ruling, and one that will have an influence on efforts to address greater transparency between the trust claim system and the bankruptcy system. Professor, do you want to have some further comments?
Yeah, just a few real quick. The Garlock case is continuing for several reasons. An auxiliary issue currently playing out has to do with the sealing of the record that was done at the outset of the case at the request of plaintiff's counsel. That was, as I predicted in my article, Judge Hodges' order sealing the record has been reversed. And we're going to see in a period of several months the record that the plaintiff's bar sought to preclude public access to. Now, there there is a subsidiary question of how that affects the confidentiality orders that were part of the access to a variety of discovery materials. So all of that is yet to play out. Moreover, in indicating that the bankruptcy judge determined in the estimation proceeding that Garlock was to would only have to pay in $125 million, that is far, far from the end of the litigation. It'll be appealed, of course. But more importantly, under Section 524G of the Bankruptcy Code, in order for a trust to be established and for all future claims against the debtor to be channeled to the trust, there must be a vote by the pending claimants, who usually cede their votes to their lawyers who have power of attorney, and there must be a two-thirds approval. And it is unlikely in the extreme that plaintiffs' lawyer counsel are going to approve in the 524G vote a $125 million estimation order or sum. And so we're going to see an intense period of negotiation underway, if it's not already, about the amount that Garlock will ultimately have to pay into the trust in order to emerge from the bankruptcy with all future asbestos claims channeled to the trust. I might also mention that perhaps as part of this negotiation, although there are independent bases for this, Garlock has filed RICO actions, I believe, against four of the law firms that have sued it and represented plaintiffs that apparently deliberately failed to disclose or refused to disclose or suppressed information about their other exposures. And perhaps all of this is part of the bargaining process as well. So I guess the answer is stay tuned. In any event, that we could turn it over now for questions.
This is Mark. Let me offer another quick comment, Professor, and a couple of practical ways that the litigation is that the decision is useful or could be of use. One of these has to deal with state legislation. For a number of years, the U.S. Chamber Institute for Legal Reform has been a leader in pursuing with state-based groups legislation to require greater transparency between the bankruptcy trust and the tort claim system. I've testified on their behalf in some states, and before Garlock, there were a few isolated incidences where it came out during discovery that plaintiffs, in some cases, were trying to tell one story to the civil jury and a different story about their exposure history to the bankruptcy trust. There was a case called Canadian several years ago in Cleveland, for instance, where this happened. And there have been a number of incidences about this, but whenever I've testified about these, the plaintiff's bar's response has been that those are isolated incidences, that they are not representative of how all firms practice, that they're not representative of asbestos litigation in general, and that there's no evidence that there is widespread fraud or suppression of evidence in the asbestos litigation. And Judge Hodge's opinion hits that head on. And so now there is a decision, not by an advocate in litigation, but by a neutral federal judge who has heard both sides of the story, roughly a month of testimony from Garlock and from the plaintiffs' committees, and from hearing all of that, what I would presume is a large volume of information, the judge has issued his findings that essentially he couldn't rely on the plaintiff's settlement approach because he did find widespread suppression of evidence. And so now I think that this is going to be a very powerful piece in the discussion about the need for bankruptcy transparency in federal legislation and in state legislation. Another thing that I would mention is that because of the really outstanding work of Garlock's lawyers, throughout their trials and throughout the product liability cases, this decision was possible. Garlock's lawyers were asking the right questions along the way about what are the plaintiff's other exposures. I've been on panels with Mary Margaret Gay of Foreman Perry in Jackson, Mississippi, and she's made this point that defense lawyers need to ask these questions about alternative exposures. They need to be very clear, and they need to follow up with those questions in interrogatories, and then before trial, it has to be in depositions of plaintiffs. Every opportunity there is, defense counsel need to press plaintiffs and their counsel to get this information of other exposures, or to get them to say that there were no other exposures, they don't recall any other exposures. It's those questions where Garlock was able to lay the foundation, where later when they got access to those trust claims, it was able for the judge to see that suppression of evidence had in fact occurred.
Oh, well said, Mark. I'm glad you added that. Just a quick note in terms of where to from here, I suspect that some insurance companies are thinking about whether the evidence that has now been uncovered that indicates not only is there fraud in terms of the tort cases against defendants and with regard to suppressing evidence of trust claim and exposures to other companies, there's also a considerable body of evidence now that the trust claims themselves are fraudulent. I guess I was searching for another word, but that's the most appropriate word. The way I phrase it is that when these claims are filed with 20, 25, 30 trusts, the work histories they list are often fungible. And this came out, as you note, in the Canadian case, counsel appear to be filling out the claim forms in such a way as to make the claimant eligible for compensation from the various trusts by simply readjusting the work history in order to qualify for compensation. And since the insurers are the ones that are largely paying for these trust claims, I would think that they are certainly giving some thought to bringing suits against the trusts, claiming that they are dissipating assets by paying obviously invalid claims, because the trusts do not do any kind of an audit of the validity and veracity of the claims. Now, the trusts claim otherwise, but that's just that's just false. The government accounting office, which did a study of the trusts, quoted several of the trustees as saying they didn't find a single case of fraud, which on its face is utterly laughable and dispositive of the question of whether or not there's a great deal of fraud in with regard just to the trust claims themselves. Okay.
Well, this is Dean breaking in. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, everybody's going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to ask a question. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We'll begin with the questions in a moment. First, I want to make a programming announcement about the rest of the schedule for the week for Teleforum. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be discussing the public defender system and a new program to provide vouchers to some criminal defendants, which allows them to, so it gives them some choice in the attorney they hire to defend them. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll learn more about the latest goings-on at the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, And then on Friday at 1 p.m., a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform will cover Integrity Staffing Solutions, Inc. versus Busk. That is the recently argued Supreme Court case about whether employee time taken to exit through a work facility security system is compensable. And do check the Federalist Society website for changes to that schedule as we move those around some and add others as well. But today, of course, we're talking to Professor Lester Brickman and Mark Behrens. If you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our first caller.
Yes, hi, this is Leo Dombrowski in Chicago, and thank you to the panelists for a very interesting and informative presentation. Has anything happened in the RICO cases that Garlock filed? I think they filed them back in January, so it's been about 9 or 10 months now.
This is Lester Brickman. The answer is undoubtedly, but the filings were under seal, and all the proceeds of the proceedings of that litigation are under seal. And the current litigation with regard to sealing the record in Garlock will significantly impact those RICO cases, at least in terms of our ability to understand or find out what's going on, because if the proceedings in Garlock are unsealed, as Judge Hodges has now ordered, or will shortly order. He made the decision but hasn't issued his formal order yet. Then we will find out at least some of the proceedings, and perhaps even more, depending upon how the confidentiality agreements that experts such as myself entered into in the Garlock case play out in view of the unsealing of the record. So it's unfortunately, I can't be more informative than that. If I did know, I couldn't tell you. But I don't know. I assume the same thing goes for Mark.
Yeah, that's right. I think we'll have to wait and see. The complaints were filed under seal. There have been some reports in the media of the firms that were named in those cases, but beyond that, the details, because they're based presumably on information that came out in the trial that is under seal, none of that is available. But Judge Hodges just a few days ago issued an order to unseal the trial record. We don't know what the final order looks like yet, and when that comes out, that may impact the what is available to see in the RICO cases, but that's something we'll just have to wait and see how that plays out.
If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to indicate so. We'll go to the next question momentarily, but first, let me ask you, Professor Brickman, how your work's being received, especially by the plaintiffs bar. One of you, I'm wondering if any of them acknowledge that fraudulently based awards to the non-injured parties, particularly from trusts that have finite assets or defendants with limited money to pay awards, are they acknowledging that that does harm legitimate plaintiffs? Is there that concession on the other side?
Well, here I can be definitive, and the definitive answer is no. Even after evidence of fraud with regard to claims against defendants in the tort system emerged, leading plaintiffs' counsel and bankruptcy counsel for plaintiffs testified in Congress that, with the exception of the Canadian case, they knew nothing about fraud. That is, they denied any evidence or knowledge of fraud. And indeed, I discussed that in the article that I cited to earlier, and showed how even at that point, those statements were clearly not valid, not consistent with the evidence. It will be interesting to see what the plaintiff bar's position is going forward. They have not challenged the evidence in Garlock. They are claiming that Garlock withheld some information. And just as they withheld information And so maybe Garlock is equally culpable or something along those lines. But they're not challenging the veracity of that evidence. They are, of course, challenging the amount set in, you know, that Judge Hodges has set in the estimation proceeding. As I said, it'll be very interesting to see the position they take once all the smoke settles.
Once again, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we had one question that just disappeared off our board. Here we are with another question. We've got this one question pending, then our lines are open. So if you would like to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call. Caller, you might have your telephone muted. If you muted your own phone, you need to come off mute.
This is Paul O'Brien. I see that the Bondex case has recently been settled. Do you have a view as to whether the Garlock decision had any effect on the way that case was settled?
Mr. O'Brien, this is Lester Brickman. I do indeed. I think that the Garlock decision redounded to the benefit of Bondex in a significant way in terms of the amount they settled for, as compared to the estimation proceeding, the estimation amount that Judge Fitzgerald awarded in her order. Bondex and Garlock are interesting cases to juxtapose because of the differing approaches of counsel in the strategy they use, counsel for the debtor. And as Mark said, and I fully subscribe to, the counsel in the bankruptcy counsel in Garlock did something that's unprecedented in terms of asbestos bankruptcies, and they uncovered evidence that showed that the settlements were, as Judge Hodges intoned, infected with the fraud with regard to suppression of evidence. This was not an approach taken by the Bondex Council, and I think that you can see the differing results. Now, there are many other differences between Bondex and Garlock. They're certainly not directly comparable, even on the very singular point that I raise. But nonetheless, Garlock's counsel should be awarded some kind of medal for doing what has not yet ever been done, which is to show clear fraud, widespread fraud with regard to malignancy cases in asbestos litigation. How wide, we don't really know, but Judge Hodges felt it was certainly very widespread. And he was somewhat embarrassed, I think, in ultimately reaching that conclusion, because earlier in the case he had consistently denied Garlock's motions for discovery and relied heavily on the plaintiff's counsel's argument that any such discovery was a waste of the assets of the debtor and nothing would be found. And, of course, we now know why plaintiff's counsel were so adamant in arguing against allowing the discovery. Ultimately, Judge Hodges relented just a bit. I mean, the amount of discovery that Garlock did, even Judge Hodges acknowledged, was quite limited. Just to conclude this, I've gone on record on this matter, and I think Bondex benefited to the tune of several hundred million dollars in its settlement because of the Garlock case.
This is Mark. I have a comment going back to the previous comment from the professor that I wanted to elaborate on, because when I've gone around different states and testified and met with people, one of the questions that comes up from people that are allied with the plaintiff's asbestos bar is that they'll suggest that, well, the Garlock ruling that we're talking about was from a federal bankruptcy court, and that there could be further appeals to the district court and to the Court of Appeals and potentially the Supreme Court, and therefore this is sort of an advisory opinion or an opinion that's going to change, and so you have to be careful about putting too much into it. But I think, and Professor said this, and I agree completely, that the challenges that seem to be forthcoming are about the dollar figure of what the judge's estimation was, not to his findings of fact in the case. I think it is very unlikely that his factual findings are ever going to change. They are what they are. Now, there might be questions about how he approached his estimation and so forth, but the facts that he found are not going to be the type of thing that will change on appeal. So to the extent that there are going to be further appeals in this case, they aren't going to affect the bottom line findings of the judge that suggest the need for greater transparency between the tort and the trust systems.
We've got one question pending, then our lines are open. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone to join the conversation. Let's go to our next caller.
David Emerson, Society member in Berkeley, California. In view of what appears to be some rather pervasive and clear fraud, have any of the parties or the judge referred this matter to the state bar associations to look at this, you know, more as a concern for the profession, or at least just for the individual lawyers and their firms involved, professional misconduct, and try to really get, you know, behind what's going on here in a way that addresses the legal profession's concerns?
Well, I'll take first crack at it. This is Lester Brickman. I wrote an article some years back titled Ethical Issues in Asbestos Litigation, in which I said that if the lawyers' codes of professional responsibility, the model rules, et cetera, adopted by the states, had been amended to include a provision that said that these rules shall not apply to asbestos litigation, there would be no change whatsoever in the way in which asbestos litigation has taken place and in the way in which sanctions by disciplinary agencies and courts and so on are meted out. In another article, I took the position that in certain mass tort litigations, and I listed asbestos, also silicone breast implants and Fen-Phen litigation, judges, disciplinary agencies, prosecutors have effectively given plaintiffs' counsel and the doctors and other medical-type professionals that they employ dispensation to commit fraud. Now, in both of those articles, I stand by those statements. There is no likelihood, in my judgment, that any of the lawyers, on the basis of Judge Hodge's determination, any of the lawyers will be sanctioned. Now, whether the RICO cases will result in any kind of determination that is that is other than monetarily adverse to the lawyers and their clients, I think is highly unlikely. And I say that from an abundance of research that I've done on the ethical issues. I've taught ethics and varieties of legal ethics and the legal profession for almost 50 years. And I stand by those statements.
This is Mark. I agree that the bar's response has been disappointing in general to the various incidences like this that have come up across asbestos. For right now, the bar associations would not be in a position to take action because the trial record is sealed as to the specific firms and specific individuals at those firms that are identified in general terms in Judge Hodge's opinion. So The opinion right now talks about a case in California, for instance, or a case in Philadelphia, a case in New York where this happened. But the facts are not out yet about what case was that, who was the plaintiff, what plaintiff's firm was engaged in that case, what individuals at the plaintiff's firm were engaged in that case. So maybe if more specific information comes out through the order to unseal, there might be more opportunity for state bars to look at this. But I go back to the situation several years ago with the case, the Canadian case in Cleveland, where Judge Harry Hanna of the Cleveland court disqualified or revoked the PROHAC privileges of a California firm and one particular lawyer in the case for conduct that he viewed as crossing over the line. And I believe that matter was sent to the California Bar Authorities, and as far as I know, nothing ever happened in that. And that was a case where there's a written opinion by a judge documenting incidences of fraud or abuse, suppression of evidence, whatever phrase you use, on the trust and on the defendant in the case. And as far as I know, the California Bar never took action in that.
This is Dean again. Is there any chance of this breaking through to the popular press? Is anybody out there other than the legal community interested in these issues?
Mark, why don't you take that?
There has been. The Wall Street Journal has editorialized about the case. When the Judge Hodges decision came out, Forbes wrote one of the early articles about this. Bloomberg Business Week has written about it. Like I said earlier, the NPR did a piece on this. There was an editorial in the Huffington Post about it. So it has been picked up in sort of more mainstream media that ordinary citizens would read. And I think that we may continue to see more about this as the record is unsealed and people learn more about what was said in the case.
It does seem, it strikes me as one of those issues that's pretty easy for people to understand, even if you're not a lawyer. We've got two questions pending, so let's take another call.
Hello, this is Luke Lafferty from Huntington, West Virginia. And I'm actually driving to the asbestos to start tomorrow. I'm kind of surprised that the judge in the bankruptcy proceeding was unaware of the fraud that's been involved in asbestos litigation for years and years. And I'm wondering if the successful RICO case that CSX Transportation brought against the Pierce firm played any part in persuading the judge that there were issues to be looked at in the bankruptcy case.
Who wants to respond to that? Lester or
Professor Brickman? Yeah, this is Lester Brickman. I'm familiar with the CSX case. In fact, I was an expert witness in that case for CSX. And I don't think it had any impact on Judge Hodges, frankly. I think Judge Hodges underwent a transformation in the course of the Garlock proceeding. Initially, he was inclined, so it appeared to me, to follow the course that most other bankruptcy judges had followed with regard to asbestos bankruptcies, which is basically to have the debtor throw all the money that it has over the wall and let the plaintiff's counsel deal with it through the trust mechanism. And that's the way most of the asbestos bankruptcies have gone. These are very complex proceedings, and frankly, the judges are very happy to get them disposed of quickly or as quickly as possible. I think in the case of Judge Hodges, he was willing to listen, and over a considerable period of time and strenuous attempts by Garlock's counsel, the debtor's counsel, the bankruptcy counsel, to educate Judge Hodges. He was willing to be educated, and as the case progressed, He became more and more willing to allow the debtor to undertake some discovery that he had previously ruled on would could not be done. And so I think all credit goes both to counsel for Garlock and to Judge Hodges for demonstrating, I guess no other bankruptcy judge had ever done. To be sure, I don't know if any other bankruptcy judge has ever been confronted with the evidence that Garlock was able to uncover. Now, as an expert for Garlock, I'm limited in terms of how extensively I can go into this, but I can simply say that I was absolutely tremendously impressed by the effort that they put in terms of discovery, using methods, and I believe this is sufficiently in the record that is available. Looking at what are called the 2019 statements, which are bankruptcy forms filed when plaintiffs' counsel represent multiple defendants, and they have to make certain statements about the fact that their clients have claims against the debtor, and then also something called master ballots. I won't get into that; it's a more technical thing. But also, it showed a discovery process that no defense counsel had ever undertaken before, to my knowledge. And so I think that's what I think the combination of the intense efforts by Garlock's counsel and the willingness of Judge Hodges to reconsider his prior decisions to preclude most discovery is what culminated in the Garlock case. I don't think the CSX case really had much effect on that. Of course, CSX is under appeal, and that will take quite some time. But ultimately, CSX could be a very, very important case. In one sense, it's the one sanction that has never been undertaken before. This is truly a man bites dog case in which the defendant, CSX Railroad, who's been sued tens of thousands of times on asbestos litigation issues, despite the fact that the evidence shows that any disease rate on the railroad from asbestos exposure is less than 1 or 2%, and as compared with the 60%, 70%, 80% rate that the plaintiff's experts testify to. Ultimately, I think that could be a very important case.
Professor, this is Mark. Let me amplify on that, because I think the caller does raise a very interesting and important concept. And while I agree that I think it's probably unlikely that Judge Hodges was influenced by this, that RICO suit may have been influential in the RICO actions that are being brought by Garlock. I don't know that the UN would draw a direct connection, but in both instances, you are seeing defendants that are both making more aggressive, offensive use of the law to try to vindicate their rights not to be defrauded or victims of suppression of evidence in their cases. So I think at that level, one could draw a connection between these as two defendants that are aggressively trying to protect their rights through the laws that are available to them. And the CSX case certainly was a pioneering case in that manner.
We've got about 15 minutes or so left, 10 minutes or so left. We've got two callers with questions pending.
Thank you for the discussion. Let me ask a question that responds to my takeaway on this call, which is that crime does pay. Why was there never any mechanism on the front end to mandate some sort of verification or due diligence with respect to the veracity of any claim? And then on the back end, I'd be interested in your thought as to why the bar or whoever the overseer is on each of the various states has been utterly disengaged from wanting to respond to what would appear to be very palpable evidence of lawyer wrongdoing. Thank you.
I'll take first crack. This is Lester Brickman. I assume that when you talk about the veracity of any claim, you're referring to the trust claims. And the answer to your question as to why there was no mechanism set up to test the veracity of trust claims is that the trusts were set up, though it was done in a bankruptcy process, were set up by the plaintiff's bar. They control the trusts. They select the trustees. Technically, the court appoints them, but they select them. They write what are called the TDPs, the trust distribution procedures, which determine how money is to be paid out. They amend the trusts when it's in their interest to do so. In my article that I've cited to earlier in the Tulane Law Review, I discuss in some detail some of the provisions in the TDPs that the plaintiff's bar added to aid in the suppression of evidence of these exposures to the products of the companies that form the trust. One of those was a confidentiality provision that said that any claim to the trust was confidential, and therefore a defendant in the tort system could not get that find out that the plaintiff in the tort case had also filed trust claims. Now that's largely been eviscerated, but it's still by court rules, by court decisions around the country, 20, 30 decisions already. But it does delay proceedings to the point where defendants in the tort system are disabled from getting the information they need in a timely fashion. There's a provision in the that was added to the TDPs that said that if a trust claimant has previously filed a tort action against the defendant, and in response to questions about whether he was exposed to any other products other than those of the defendants, and he said emphatically no, and then after that files a claim with a trust saying exactly the opposite, I was exposed to your product, then that provision in the TDP says that's fine, you can do that, and we don't take into account anything you've testified to elsewhere when you put in a trust claim. A third TDP provision says that after you file a trust claim, you can unfile it in essence. You can file a trust claim so that you have certain statute of limitations requirements to file within a certain time period, and that will toll the time period so that you're safely in. But then you can withdraw the claim so that when you file in the trust system, you file a case in the trust system, and you're asked, have you filed any trust claims? You can answer no, and then can refresh your trust claim after that tort case is concluded and go ahead with it. So these are, in my judgment, these are clearly written into the TDPs by the plaintiff's bar in order to facilitate fraud. And that's the nature of the system. It's a system set up by lawyers, run by lawyers, for lawyers, and I'm sorry to be so startling in some sense, but that's the reason why there is no verification. The lawyers set it up so that they can jiggle those piggy banks and bring out the billions as they want. As far as why the bar is disengaged, well, I'm not going to go into any, I'm not going to comment on that, but I don't think the bar's position here is any different than the bar's position in many other circumstances.
Professor, this is Mark. Let me comment on that also briefly on the state legislation, because the caller hits on the exact issue here is that, and you did as well, Professor, based on the timing of when trust claims are made, it's possible for a plaintiff to bring, and in most cases, this is what the plaintiffs do. They bring their tort case first. They wait until the tort case settles or go to verdict, and then they file their trust claims. And they could tell a different story of their exposure history of the trust claims. And in most states, there is no way for the truth to catch the lie, because there's no opportunity after the settlement or after the judgment to go find out what trust claims were made and what statements were made in them. Garlock is an exception because they were able to get that information by going through bankruptcy. But ordinarily, companies are not able to get that information after the settlement. The legislation that's being considered in various states and has been enacted in Ohio and Oklahoma and in Wisconsin addresses that very problem. And what the legislation does is it changes the ordering in which the filing of the trust claims occurs and says that a plaintiff must file all of his or her trust claims before the case is set for trial. And that way, all of the information about the plaintiff's exposures are available. You're able, through that transparency, to see if the plaintiff is telling inconsistent stories of his or her exposure history. And the juries then are able to reach fully informed decisions about who is really at fault for the plaintiff's injury after hearing the totality of evidence of the totality of the person's exposures.
I think we have time for one final question, so let's move in that direction.
Hi, my name's Harry Lewis. I'm a bankruptcy lawyer up here in New York. I served as a trustee in bankruptcy several decades ago and also actually was bankruptcy counsel to some plaintiff's lawyers in a very early asbestos case back at the time of the Johns Manville decision. So I'm actually confessing my advanced age, but I have not closely followed the asbestos issue over the last, say, 15 or 20 years. What I'm hearing is extremely interesting. And Professor Brickman, you answered part of my question about how this could occur in the system that was set up. But I have a sort of a bankruptcy-oriented question about the mass tort system and the way this the entire system was set up, because it seems to me that what we got, and your expression was throwing the case over the wall, what we got from the bankruptcy bench, and I guess part of the bankruptcy bar, was a system controlled by plaintiff's lawyers, that is a mass tort claim system, controlled essentially by the plaintiff's bar, in which you have elements of Star Chamber, because it's a secret system. You have elements of the fox in the hen house, because it seems like the people who are making the claims to collect money on behalf of their own clients are controlling the claim system. And, of course, in bankruptcy and in the bankruptcy court, one of my jobs as a trustee was to examine claims which had to be signed under penalty of perjury, right, and had to be amended if they were erroneous in any way. And, of course, the claims process, that is examining the various claims in bankruptcy and allowing or disallowing them, was itself, you know, adversarial. And if there was an objection to a claim, you ended up in front of a bankruptcy judge, and you had basically a trial on the issue of the validity of the claim. So you had full due process protections in the bankruptcy system. I guess my question to the panel is, looking forward, I hear that there are some reforms at the state level, but wouldn't a better solution looking forward be to essentially require what I'll call quasi-bankruptcy rules about claims in that process, where, for example, claimants have to sign proof of claim forms under penalty of perjury, where the process is transparent, that is available to the public in general, where decisions made about claims can be objected to, you know, by any creditor, at least in the bankruptcy system, and where the entire claims process is wide open to the public, in commensurate with what we used to view as pretty conventional notions, both of bankruptcy law and of due process and of fairness to all creditors and to everyone in the system. So looking forward, what's your view about what can be done in that respect?
Well, this is Lester Brickman. I confess that I am far, far from being an expert in bankruptcy law. And so I'm going to defer to Mark on this, even though he's not a bankruptcy lawyer, but he's had more contact with that area. The one thing I would say is when you say that one thing that that might be done is to have the claimant sign claim forms under proof of perjury with regard to the validity of their
penalty
claim.
Of perjury, forgive me, yeah, penalty of perjury.
And the answer is they do now. It just doesn't mean anything. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mark.
Thank you, Professor. This is Mark Behrens. I think there are a number of things that can be done. At a minimum, I think that the Congress should have further hearings about this case and the need for greater transparency in the between the bankruptcy and the tort systems. The House Judiciary Committee has had some hearings on this already. I think more would be helpful in light of Garlock to learn more about the case, particularly after the record is unsealed. I think it would also there's also federal legislation pending called the FACT Act, which would require the trust to make quarterly reports of who made claims with them in that quarter and what the exposure, what exposures the plaintiffs were alleging, as another tool to see whether plaintiffs are being truthful when they make claims against the trust compared to the statements they're making in the tort system. And I'm not a bankruptcy lawyer, but I think that that there should be further exploration in terms of the impact of the plaintiff's bar in being able to control the proceedings. So, for instance, if Judge Hodges says that he believes that a fair settlement of the case is $130 million, I think that that should mean something, and I don't know today how impactful that is, where ultimately the settlement will be approved when the plaintiff's lawyers decide to approve it with the votes that they have. That's the way Section 524G is written. I think that there may be some opportunity for the judge to cram down, as I understand it, it is called the confirmation on the parties. But by and large, the system seems to be written to give the plaintiff's bar an unreasonable amount of control over the process, and I think that that would be worth further exploration and dialogue to see whether the trust are operating in a way that is fair, not only for the debtor company, but also for all claimants, including future claimants, and whether the TDPs are too loose in terms of paying people with little or perhaps no exposure to the debtor's product. And not only what is the impact on the debtor for doing that, or on the, but also on the trust with respect to future claimants with legitimate claims.
I'm afraid we're going to have to let that be the final word. We are out of time. In fact, we're past time. I'm going to give my very sincere thanks to Professor Lester Brickman and Mr. Mark Behrens for the presentations today, one of our more disturbing teleforum conference calls, frankly. A reminder to our audience that our next call is now scheduled for tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll be talking about vouchers in the public defender system. It's 2 p.m. tomorrow, Eastern Time. But until that next teleforum conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.